This April 25th meeting of the Senate Finance Committee will come to order. We hope to have two bills on the agenda today. The second one will come after session. The first one we're hoping to finish before session. Senator Latz is here with Senate File 5337, the Public Safety Policy and Appropriations Provision Modifications. Senator Latz, welcome to the Finance Committee.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and members, it's a pleasure to be here on my annual trek from the judiciary public safety space into the Finance Committee. I appreciate the budget target that we were given. It was something that we could work with to meet the needs, obviously, like every area, we'd like to have more because we have more needs that we perceive than there is money available, but I also respect that there are limited funds available just generally. Much of what we were given got immediately, was already spoken for, basically, which didn't leave us with a lot of discretionary dollars, but we have used some of that. So I think what we have presented here is a reasonable budget that will meet critical needs, that will advance public safety, that will take care of what the courts need for security, for psychological services and interpreters, as far as we can get there. Those needs, by the way, are going to be ongoing shortfalls that have to be addressed just because the demand has increased so much. So I think what I'll do is I'll have fiscal staff walk through the specifics, and then I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator Latz. Mr. Turner, you ready to go through the spreadsheet?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chair and members. First of all, I'll go over the overall budget target for judiciary and public safety. It's $53.9 million for fiscal years 24 and 25, with tails of $17.22 million for 26 and 27. The House, the Senate, and the Governor's Office created two sub-targets for this budget, and they can be seen in the bottom two lines of the spreadsheet. The judiciary sub-target is $36 million for 24 and 25, with $3 million in 26 and 27 tails. And the public safety sub-target is $17.9 million in 24-25, with $14.22 million in 26-27 tails. And I'll start on the spreadsheet on line three under the Supreme Court, court cybersecurity. The bill appropriates $5,250,000 in fiscal year 25. This appropriation is available until the end of fiscal year 27, which means the bill appropriates the equivalent of $1,750,000 each year for 3 years. We move on to line four, safe and secure courthouse grants. There's a one-time appropriation of $500,000. Then to the district courts, line 10, psychological services deficit. The bill appropriates $5,317,000 in fiscal year 24. And $15,951,000 in fiscal year 25. The second year appropriation is available till the end of fiscal year 27. So that's the equivalent of $5,317,000 appropriated each year for 3 years. Then line 11, we have psychological examiners. This is an hourly rate increase from $125 to $138 an hour. That provision costs $1,203,000 in 25 with identical tails, 1203 in 26 and 27. Line 12 is court interpreters deficit. In fiscal year 24, the appropriation is $1,290,000. In fiscal year 25, it's $3,870,000. And like just like the psychological services deficit on line 10. The second year appropriation is available until the end of fiscal year 27. So it's the equivalent of appropriating $1,290,000 each year for 3 years. Line 13 is court interpreters, hourly rate increase from $65 to $75. That's $235,000 in fiscal year 25. The committee has tails for this item at $297,000 each year in 26 and 27. That works out to an additional $1.30 hourly increase. So it'd be for 26 and 27, the hourly increase would be $76.30 for court interpreters. Line 14 is the jury program deficit. Bill appropriates $20,000 in fiscal year 24, which was kind of a remainder on our target. And then $2,364,000 in 25, which once again is appropriated for 3 years or is available until the end of fiscal year 27. So it's the equivalent of $788,000 each year for 3 years. Then we move from the courts to the Department of Corrections, line 20. The governor's request operating adjustment, $5,900,000 in 24, $1,990,000 in 25, with tails of $7,091,000 each year in 26 and 27. Then we have the Department of Public Safety, line 26. Crime Victim Services, a one-time appropriation of $9,200,000. Then we have four Senate provisions. On line 27, we have Senate File 4258, Report on Preventing Violence Against Latina Women, a one-time appropriation of $250,000. We have Senate File 3662, Juvenile Crime Reduction Grants, one-time appropriation of $500,000. Then we have Senate File 5243, the Hmong American Mediation Center, a one-time appropriation of $50,000. And finally, we on line 30, we have Senate File 3900, Digital GIS School Mapping. It's a $7 million appropriation from the 911 E Fund. The next two lines, 38 and 44, concern the Clemency Review Board. Line 38 appropriates $986,000 in fiscal year 25, 26, 27 to the board. Line 44 cancels an identical amount from the DOC, the Department of Corrections, appropriation that was made last year. And this is part of the governor's recommendation to move the board out from under the DOC and establish it as an independent entity. And finally, we have one more item, general fund impacts from other legislation. This spreadsheet is carrying the costs of Senate File 4312, safe storage of firearms. These are DOC bed costs. This bill is moving separately with an appropriation to the DOC. And that appropriation is $10,000 in 25 and $19,000 in 26 and 27 tails. And that, Mr. Chairman, is the spreadsheet. I'll quickly go over Article 1 before I turn over Article 2 and 3 to Mr. Backus. Article 1 basically implements the spreadsheet. Section 1 is the appropriation format. Section 2 is appropriations to the Supreme Court, the court cybersecurity, and safe and secure courthouse grants. Section 3 is the district courts, psychological services, psychological examiners pay rate increase, court interpreters, court interpreter pay rate increase, and the increased cost of jury programs. Section 4 is the Department of Public Safety. Subdivision 1 is the total appropriation summary. Subdivision 2 is the Crime Victim Services appropriation, a governor's request with which the committee concurred. Subdivision 3 is the appropriation for Senate File 4258, Senator Mann's Preventing Violence Against Latina Women report. Subdivision 4, the appropriation language for Senate File 3662, Senator Omover Baden's Youth Support Services Grants. On the spreadsheet, this is listed as juvenile crime reduction grants. Subdivision 5 is the appropriation language for the Hmong American Mediation Center, a Senator Herr provision. And Subdivision 6 is the appropriation language for the Digital Geographic Information System Mapping for School Facilities, a Senator Seeberger provision. And that's it for DPS. We move on to page 6. Section 5 is the Department of Corrections operating increase. Section 6 is the clemency review appropriation as an independent entity. And then we have Section 7 on page 7. It's a budget-neutral governor's request that makes the urban search and rescue and the Minnesota Air Rescue Team eligible to receive reimbursements from the Non-Responsible Party Fund for hazardous material response. Sections 8 and 9 are the DOC cancellations of the fiscal year '25 appropriation for the clemency review board. It's $986,000 a year. This money is reappropriated back in Section 6 to the commission as an independent entity. Then we move to page 10. Section 10 is the implementation language for the report preventing violence against Latino women and queer Latines in Minnesota, Senator Mann provision. Section 11 is the implementation language for Senate File 3662, Senator Omover Baden Youth Support Services Grants. And yes, Section 11, that's it for Article 1. So I'll turn it over to...
Thank you, Mr. Turner. Mr. Backus, you going to go over Article 2?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members. I'm just going to go through Articles 2 and 3 fairly briefly. So Article 2 is entitled Public Safety. It begins on page 12 of the bill. Sections 1 to 3 and 7 amend the dispositional provisions for the various juvenile offender laws. Here we're talking delinquency, juvenile petty offenses, major highway and water traffic offenses. These provisions authorize the juvenile to participate in a restorative justice, restorative process to satisfy restitution obligations. Also authorizes the Office of Restorative Practices to award grants to provide restitution funds to victims. Sections 4 and 5 redefine two terms, state emergency response asset and urban search and rescue in the Department of Public Safety's chapter of law. Section 6 authorizes the Department of Public Safety to use up to 10% of youth intervention program appropriations for administrative costs related to the program rather than the current 2%. Section, Article 3 is entitled Corrections. It begins on page 19 of the bill. Section 1 requires local correctional facilities to report specified information relating to their communications contracts for incarcerated persons within their facilities. Sections 2 to 6 and 8 amend the MRRA law. MRRA stands for Minnesota Rehabilitation and Reinvestment Act. It was enacted last year. These provisions expand the Earned Incentive Release Program to include individuals on conditional release, not just supervised release. Section 7 is related to that. It updates the community supervision funding formula to include the appropriation of MRRA savings, which corrects an omission from last year's bill. Finally, Sections 9 to 12 address both the Cannabis Expungement Board and the Clemency Review Commission. They do two things. They strike language that ties the executive director's salaries of those entities to a repeal provision of law, and also extends the period that the Department of Corrections is required to provide administrative support to those entities. Mr. Chair, those are the remaining articles of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Backus and Mr. Turner. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Dreheim.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Senator Latz, for bringing this forward. I do have an amendment, members, and I'd like to offer the A16 right now, and then I can explain it.
Sure. It is in the packets. A16 is in the packets. Senator Dreheim, on the A16 amendment.
Thank you, Chair. This is $5 million appropriation to the Commissioner of Public Safety for the emergency communication network, for the radio system, the allied radio matrix for emergency response. And the reason I drafted this amendment, there are a couple of my communities and really small towns with volunteer firefighters, not a lot of tax base, one or two commercial buildings in the whole town. The rest are just homes. And their radios are 40 plus years old, and their towers are shot also. Everything needs to be updated. The whole system needs to be updated. And I know you have a target, like we all have, but I think this is something that is extremely important. You know, if we have communities that can't communicate, and most of the public safety is countywide, and you have sparse populated public safety personnel, you know, a lot of these counties might have one or two sheriff deputies on at any given time, and then rely on EMS and fire service by volunteers. So I think it's important that we give them the tools to do their job, and this is a matching program. The state picks up 75%. The local community would have to come up with 25%. Priority is given to the communities that have not received a grant in the past, and it goes till 2026. Pretty straightforward, members.
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, I support the goal and purpose of the amendment. There are critical needs all over the state of Minnesota for aging radio infrastructure in the emergency communication space. This is the second or third, actually this would probably be the fourth proposal, if I remember right, that we've seen introduced this year as independent bills from members trying to get funds into their own areas for these reasons. We have not funded any of them within our budget, but I recognize the need. I would not support the amendment to the extent that it would change any of the allocations within our target. I have no problem if the committee is willing to either increase the target. I wouldn't want it increased, because if I got an increased target, I'd have other things that I might prioritize over this as well. But if the committee wants to fund it out of general fund without impacting our target, that's the committee's decision, not mine. I will tell the members that we are working, and I just had a conversation with agency staff as well. We're working on what I think there really needs to be, which is a long-term dedicated revenue stream to fund what will be an ongoing expense as far into the future as we can see, because radios have a life cycle, right? Technology gets better, the equipment ages in its function, and so this is an ongoing expense. I think it needs an ongoing dedicated revenue source to pay for that expense, to the extent that we want the state to be involved in that funding. So we're going to work on it, and I don't know if we can pull it together for this session or not. I would love to get this problem solved so it's not knocking on our doorstep every budget year and competing against all the other bunch of priorities that we have.
Thank you, Senator Latz. Senator Dreheim, then Senator Friends.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Senator Latz. Well, I hope as we work through the process through the rest of the year, if you do get some more funding available, that you would consider some type of program to help out you know, communities all across the state, especially those with lower budgets and geographic challenges, you know, bigger counties with low density. So,
Mr. Chairman, I forgot to add that in the current budget that we have in place right now, there is $4 million, $2 million per year for armor grants throughout the state. It's an application process, so every community could apply for that grant, but I will certainly acknowledge that that amount of funding is insufficient to meet the need. It's something like a $250 million projected need in the state. So this would be helpful, I guess, for individual communities, but it'd be window dressing in the big picture.
Senator Frentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Dreheim. The small towns in my district look a lot like the small towns in your district. I support the spirit of what you're trying to do. I have not heard from towns like Lafayette, Nicollet, Cortland about their radio needs, but I'm happy to work with you offline. Having said that, can't support the A16 if it breaks a target. As you know, once we break a target on one bill and one provision, we're going to get a phone call from some other bill authors about breaking the targets for their bills, and once we go down that rabbit hole, it's tough. But you have my pledge, Senator Dreheim, to work on that.
Is there further discussion on the A16 amendment of Senator?
Senator Marty, yes. I will withdraw the A16. I wanted to bring it up for discussion. I think it's something we need to work on. And I know $5 million isn't enough, but I just wanted to prove a point and bring it to everybody's attention. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dreheim. He withdraws the A16 amendment. And on that point, again, I think it's important to recognize that Senator Latz's budget has so many needs like this that are very great. And next year being an appropriation year, I hope, and maybe you do find some dedicated funding for armor. But yeah, when you say $250 million in needs, $4 million or $5 million is a little bit, and it's better than nothing. But I understand the difficulty. So. Are there further discussion or questions for any of the staff or anyone? Senator Pratt.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, it's not really a question. It's just more of a discussion, and it has to do on the spreadsheet with the number of items that are, you know, listed as $1.7 million for 3 years, $5.3 million for 3 years. Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, my concern here is as I read through the bill, we're using one-time money to fund ongoing needs. And I think what we're going to find ourselves is while, you know, in the grand scheme of things, these adjustments aren't very large compared to a $70 billion budget. I think it sets a bad precedent for us to be relying on one-time money for these ongoing needs. And I've got a concern in just the basic structure of what we proposed under that under that precedent. So, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to make that concern known. I think the new concern is after increasing taxes over $9 billion last year, we're hearing in the Finance Committee, Senator Latz is proposing a new revenue stream, i.e. new tax, coming up in the future. And I think Minnesota families are already overburdened. So I'll be interested to see where he wants to pull that new money from. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, do you have any? Ms. Stengel has the effective date amendments that we need for some of the appropriations that are touching into the current fiscal year. Ms. Stengel, could you go ahead?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are four sections in Article 1 that touch appropriations in the current fiscal year. They are sections 3, 4, 5, and 9. And the motion would be to add an immediate effective date to each of those sections. So I'll read the page and line numbers for all of those. It would be on page 3 after line 11. That's section 3. For section 4, that would be page 6, line 19. For section 5, that's page 6, line 31. And for section 9, page 10, line 4. and in each of those spots to insert the phrase effective date, period. This section is effective the day following final enactment.
Senator Friends moves that effective date amendment for those four sections. Is there any discussion of that amendment? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And on the issue, Senator Vats, I think the difficulty you have and the state has in terms of when you have some one-time money available and how you deal with ongoing needs, and I think doing it over a three-year thing is obviously the best way to do that, perhaps. And Senator Pratt's right that we got to be careful with that, obviously, because that. But again, that's the same reason we have structural imbalances. If you hate to spend the same amount you take in a two-year period, you're never touching the one-time money. And we made a strategic decision last year to spend that one-time money as much as you can on one-time things, but there's so many ongoing needs, and I think this is a very responsible budget, though I know you, in dealing with the departments and the courts and public safety needs and everything, I think you've done a very good job of this, and I appreciate the hard work.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Glatz.
I appreciate your words, Mr. Chairman, and if I would just highlight where we have targeted those one-time funds over a period of time, perhaps you have the committee will have a little better understanding of why we did it. The courts have an issue with cybersecurity that they need to address, and it is definitely an ongoing concern. The courts have some of the most sensitive personal information on people that exists out there. They switched over internal digital record keeping systems because the old one became so old that the vendor no longer supported it. It had major security risks. And in fact, there was another state where they had a breach of their system and they had to go from digital to paper in their entire statewide court system for about 4 months, slowed everything down, including justice. The system was so bad that there were people in that court system that had never worked in a paper-only world that had to learn how to do that. That's the need here, and we understand that's going to be an ongoing need, but it's not something that necessarily creates, a cliff that anyone's going to fall off of if at the end of this budget cycle that money is there. It's just, it will expire. The other areas where we focused were court interpreters and psychological services. Now, part of what we're doing with this budget is filling in a deficit because both of these areas are constitutionally mandated obligations that the courts have to provide to participants in the judicial system. If someone, and so they've been providing it for the last couple of years, and the demand has substantially increased over that time. There are far more defendants coming into the system and others for whom the psychological services, the forensic analyses need to be done to determine if a person is competent to participate in their own criminal defense, and also to determine whether or not they were laboring under a mental illness that was so bad at the time of the alleged offense that they couldn't tell the difference between right and wrong conduct, which is a legal defense to a criminal charge, where theoretically they could be put in prison if they are convicted. So those services are constitutionally mandated. Even now, the doctors that are providing that analysis are underpaid by 40% or more compared to other comparably educated doctors in other parts of state government. So what we are proposing hardly makes a dent in increasing their compensation compared to where they could go elsewhere in government, let alone private practice, to provide these services. But they're an absolutely critical part of state government. We needed to recognize that, of the courts. For interpreters, similar increase in demand. And in fact, so bad that the contract interpreters went on a work stoppage for 4 months in the state court system and slowed everything down. There were many defendants would get to court. They have no idea what's going on because they don't speak English, yet they are charged with a crime. Often they would come to court. There were no interpreters available. And the cases got continued for another day, which delayed justice and cost them time off from work as well. And it's not just in the criminal justice system. Interpreters are used throughout the judicial system. They can get paid far more in the federal court system and in private practice in their other options. This does not get close to compensating them, but we have to do something there. So for at least the next 2 or 3 years, they're going to have a little bit of a bump. They went about 50 years without seeing any increase in their compensation. In 1970s, they were earning $50 an hour. Before the most recent budget, they were earning $56 an hour. That's a negligible increase. Their purchasing power plummeted during that period of time. So this budget will get, they're at 65 right now. This will get them up to 75 for the next couple of years to try to, frankly, entice some of them to stay in the justice system. So, it creates a little bit of a fiscal cliff at the end, but it will meet critical needs now, and that's why we funded them.
And Senator Latz, thanks for working with the court administrator, because I was hearing how strong those concerns were about shutting down the courts if we don't have the appropriate people there. Senator Westrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Senator Latz, just on your last point, and then I've got another follow-up. So the 75 an hour for those folks getting paid, typical 2,000 hour year is what they consider a work year. Their salary, their compensation would be up to $150,000. What do we pay judges?
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrom, I appreciate your question, but your premise is flawed because they don't work 2,000 hours a year. There are a small portion of the interpreters that are employed full-time by the judicial system, and this is not relating to their salaries. Most of the interpreters are contract. They're private interpreters, they're on contract, and there's a contract from the courts to pay them. They don't get paid, they don't work 2,000 hours a year. They have a minimum 2-hour time frame when they are needed that right now doesn't even include travel time to and from the courts. And in your district, if they're traveling from their home to the courts, it could be an hour or longer each way to get to the courts, for which they're not being compensated. Once they get into court, they've got a 2-hour minimum. If they're doing it remotely, right now they don't even have that. It's not accurate to say that they work 2,000 hours a year. They work far fewer hours a year, and on that contract basis, they can get paid far more doing other work, frankly. So some of them are opting to do that. If they make a commitment to 2 hours, they accept a job for 2 hours in a morning at, say, the Ridgedale District Court in Hennepin County, they can't find any other work to fill in the rest of that morning. And they won't know if they're going to be needed for 2 hours or 4 hours. They might be done with their one case within an hour. And if they were doing it in some other world, they could end up being uncompensated for several hours. If they accepted a federal job, they get guaranteed 4 hours for that half day. But they have to pick and choose. So that's what their options are. If they accept a private interpreter case for a deposition, for example, where they're going to be working 8 hours a day and they're going to get compensated at a rate of $100 an hour or more, you know, they're making serious choices as to whether they're willing to give up $1,000 a day so that they can do the court work. So that's the practical reality here.
So Mr. Chair and Senator Latz, on that point, it kind of sounds like you're making the case that our judiciary system should do a better job of consolidating these needs, like they've done with the drug court, like they've done with the housing court, like they've done with small claims. They docket them all on the same day or the same afternoon to bring some efficiency. It seems to me if they know in advance if they're going to need interpreters, they could do the same thing for those cases. So people could have, we could use the same interpreters if we're having such a struggle finding them, which I believe probably is the case. Sometimes we got to push government to find efficiencies just like the private sector. And so it seems to me your answer just gave us a very logical argument that the judicial system needs to sharpen their pencil a little bit on streamlining this so that people contracting could have a half a day or a full day and move those cases. They know what they are. They do that already with lots of cases and types of cases that they consolidate on a calendar, you know, a certain day of the month or certain times, as you well know, too. So just an idea as you're talking, that thought is coming to me. And so maybe while we add some compensation, maybe we should also insist on some more streamlining so they can have these interpreters who have a valuable skill get their 2,000 hours and use or closer to that, so we can compensate them but use their services and not have people, you know, running for 2 hours if we can possibly streamline it better. But you don't need to respond to that, just a thought as we're talking about this. I know the courts are listening, and hopefully they can take that to heart, because we think of just case consolidation, but you raise a good point of this could also be something they streamline and merge, rather than having one in the morning and one later in the week and one another time, and et cetera, et cetera. But another question I had, Senator Latz, is you've got tens of thousands of dollars in here that you're carrying for safe storage firearms requirement, or the bill that's moving through that we had last week. What is that money going to be used for? Can you explain to us why, what you're carrying money for, that bill and this bill, and what the purpose of that is?
Senator Latz. Mr. Chairman, those are bed costs, which are fairly low as crimes go, but we have to carry that because the fiscal note projects at least a few uses of prison beds in connection with this proposal. So the DOC fiscal note came back at that. Mr. Chairman, I would like to respond to Senator Westrom's earlier comments, if I may.
Sure,
briefly.
Please. Go ahead.
Two things. One is, I appreciate the suggestion. I'm sure the courts do, and I would anticipate, I would hope that they look to try to consolidate as much as they can. But first of all, we don't have the authority to insist that the judicial branch adjust their scheduling practices. They're an independent, constitutionally independent branch of government, and we don't have the legal authority to force them to schedule in any particular way. But also, scheduling cases is a function of a whole lot of different factors, not only the language of the defendant, but the schedule of the prosecuting attorney, the schedule of the defense attorney, whether it's a public defender's office or private counsel. It's in the more populous counties where you've got city attorneys that are independently prosecuting cases, and it's not all one county attorney's office. Then it's a function of which day of the week that city attorney is scheduled to be in the courthouse. In the Ridgedale Courthouse, for example, if you go there on Thursdays, the Edina city attorney is there Thursday mornings. So if there's an Edina case that needs an interpreter, they're not going to schedule it Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, or Friday. It's Thursday morning. That's the only time. It's also a function of availability of witnesses for contested hearings. And even where the county attorneys are handling municipal prosecution, which happens in some counties like Scott County, they don't handle municipal cases for one city in Scott every day of the week. They will have one day of the week where they do the cities from this city and another day for another city. So all of those factor in, and frankly, you need a pretty complicated algorithm probably to start factoring in interpreter needs in there. Although I agree it ought to be a consideration, to the extent that the courts can, I would encourage them to consolidate those as well.
Thank you, Senator Glatz. And we have Commissioner Schnell from Department of Corrections here, and also Commissioner Jacobson. Would either of you like to briefly speak to the needs, to the bill and everything? You're welcome to do so. Commissioner Schnell first, I guess, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll make my comments very briefly. I just want to thank the committee, Chair Latz, and the Judiciary Committee for the thoughtful work that they put into the bill. I think it is representative of the needs, certainly of the Department of Corrections, as well as the public safety needs. Crime victims are well represented, which is certainly a balanced consideration in the bill. And you know, I share the concerns around the, as we talked about beforehand, around the armor radio system as a significant public safety need, both for the Department of Corrections and public safety agencies across the state. And certainly, I think the Commissioner Jacobson and I and the Chair would be happy to work on that as a recognized need across our state. So we're happy to answer any questions, but we do see the bill before you as a very balanced approach, and certainly we all wish that there was more resources available to meet the needs, but we do see it as balanced. So thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Jacobson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Bob Jacobson, Commissioner of Public Safety, thanks for asking us to come up, and again, our thanks. As Commissioner Schnell mentioned, I think this is a balanced bill that I think is helpful. I would like to specifically give our thanks for the funding for crime victims. I mentioned that this week is National Crime Victim Services Week. I think it's really important to recognize, and we have seen many high-profile events in our state in the last several weeks involving domestic abuse and other assaults on victims throughout the state of Minnesota. I think this additional funding will go a long way toward helping those in our communities who are certainly suffering from as victims of crime. But again, our thanks. We appreciate the opportunity to be here, and we thank you for your efforts and for your work. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both, commissioners, and I'll note that both departments have sent letters of support for the bill in the packets, along with the state court administrator as well. So is there further discussion on the bill? If not, Senator Friends moves that Senate File 5337 as amended be recommended to pass. Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, just a final comment on the dollars that are being carried in here under the safe storage, and how many potential Minnesotans that bill is going to be criminalizing just from practices that just those going hunting, Mr. Chair and members, Senator Latz, across the entire state of Minnesota. I did it when I was young. You oftentimes would anticipate getting your gun ready out of storage, out of a closet where you probably haven't had it out for months before hunting season, unloaded. I usually set it close to the front door, so when you get up early to get out to the slough, you're not up rummaging around the house, waking other people up and having to find your gun and get it out of a storage closet. But that is what we're criminalizing here and putting money towards putting people in jail. That's how far at extreme that bill is going, and so I just want to raise that. That money is being approved here to make all of those Minnesotans going out to hunt, planning ahead the night before, criminals. If they plan ahead and leave their gun by their front door unloaded, cased, ready to go hunting, but it's out of their reach, and if they're going with a child or somebody under 18, they're now going to be criminalized. So I just want to raise that point, Mr. Chair. I know you want to get ready for a vote, but thought I'd make that point so people understand how severe this is.
Thank you, Senator Westrom. Last comment, Senator Letts.
Mr. Chairman, with all due respect, Senator Westrom, that's just factually inaccurate with respect to the language in the Safe Storage Bill, which is a separate bill which the legislature will have an opportunity to determine. We're just carrying the money in the event that that becomes law. But a simple trigger lock would solve every problem that you just identified and would make sure that no young person or anyone else in the house could have access to that gun and kill themselves, or a baby brother or anyone else as they're playing around with it. For the sake of not waking someone up in the morning when you're getting ready to go hunting, I'd make that trade-off. I'd save the baby brother in the household rather than not waking someone up in the morning. Also, as I understand the way the Safe Storage Bill is written, if it were in a gun case, as you just said these guns typically are, all you got to do is have a lock on the gun case, and that would meet the needs of the safe storage requirements as well. If my recollection, no one, by the way, is just for violating this law. I think actually the terms is it's a petty misdemeanor on a first offense, if I remember right. I'm not entirely sure about that. Secondly, you never get to a prison bed unless you've done this a bunch of times. So anyone who violates this a first or even a second time is not going to see a bed cost in our Department of Corrections. That's going to be if someone has violated this law, done it enough times and has a substantial criminal history score, that's going to put them into a presumptive commit and will end up in prison as a result. So I just think the scaremongering is inappropriate. I'd make the trade-off to save the lives of kids in the household any day.
No further discussion. Senator Friends moves that Senate File 5337 as amended be recommended to pass. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. With that, thank you, Senator Letts. Thank you, Commissioners, and thank you, Mr. Rapakis and Mr. Turner. With that, we are going to recess until probably half an hour. Depends how long session goes, but probably half an hour after session adjourns, we will come back and take up the E-12 bill. With that, no further business. This committee is in recess.